This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. If you're a fan of the history detectives on PBS, then you know our guest, Tukufu Zuberi. He's one of the hosts who have tracked down historical objects to find out about the stories that they tell. His experience on that show inspired him to make a documentary titled African Independence. It's about the history of colonization and includes interviews with leaders and freedom fighters about their visions and struggles to create a new Africa. His film will be shown at the Penn Museum in Philadelphia on October 17th at 5 o'clock. The museum is also hosting an exhibition of Zuberi's war posters called Black Bodies in Propaganda. The Independence Seaport Museum is also hosting another of his exhibits. It's called Tides of Freedom, African Presence on the Delaware River. Tukufu Zuberi is the Lasry Family Professor of Race Relations, Professor of Sociology and Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. He's on sabbatical this year doing work in Latin America, just came in from Latin America, and it's a great pleasure to have you with us on Radio Times.
Marty, it is such a pleasure to be here.
And we spent about 5 minutes talking about his very lovely hat before we went on the air here.
I'm a big fan of hats. I wear a lot of them, both figuratively, metaphorically,
yes, exactly.
And really.
And it's a lovely hat that I'm staring at there. Your documentary, African Independence, begins with something that you say: if you don't know about Africa, you can't understand the world. When did that become clear to you?
You know, I have been interested in Africa for a long time, and that interest has really pulled me into the significance of Africa in a less romantic way than most people would look at it. So I don't just see the lions. I don't see the big elephants or the tall things. I do see those, and I have been there. I've been on safaris and all of that stuff. And I don't just see poverty. I don't just see disease. I don't just see war. I see something that is a beautiful, shining light, and that's what I see in the people of Africa. And it reminds me of the best moments in American history, the best moments in America's transition to being the society that it's in. And I think that if we don't understand what's going on in Africa, it's because we don't really understand what's going on in the world. Mm. And, you know, sometimes we can get a little arrogant because the United States is the biggest economy, the shining light of democracy, our processes of redress and trying to struggle around issues is known all over the world and definitely is seen in how the government is almost frozen because of the ability of people to argue from a variety of perspectives. We can get arrogant and not think that the rest of the world is as important as it is. And like in the history detectives where we find those jewels in history which help connect people to what their past is, to our collective past, and give, hopefully, a better understanding of possible futures. I think that what Africa offers the world is hope. What Africa offers the world is a reflection on how a group of people, a continent, was on the bottom and is on the rise. Mm. And sometimes we don't see the rise.
Well, it's interesting you say that because I think there's so many misunderstandings about Africa. First, it's a continent, not a country.
Exactly.
And it is more than the famines that we read about, the civil wars that we read about, the poverty, the AIDS, the corruption, the violent governments. I mean, all of that is true.
It is true.
But there is, I think, another part of the as you say, the people living on this continent, in these various countries, that really can tell a different story.
And there's the part that Africa plays for itself, among itself. You know, so there's all these 53 different nations, over 2,000 languages and dialects, culture so full and rich that Africa is bursting at the seams with diversity. And all of the conflicts and all of the beauty that that brings is reflected on the African continent. At the same time, Africa offers solutions to the economic needs of China. Africa offers solutions to the economic interests of the Middle East. Africa offers solutions to mineral needs and resources in the United States. And those things are flowing. They're flowing out of Africa, while at the same time, Africa is not treated as an equal partner in world affairs. And mainly because a lot of the protocol, a lot of the relationships and the standards for how nations relate to each other, these things were formed. They were put in place before Africans took over their own governments. So they didn't have a say in the formation of the United Nations. They didn't have a real say in the formation of the International Criminal Court. They didn't have a real say in the formation of the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund or how they would relate to these institutions. And that is not a problem as long as Africa is not considered and not on your radar. But once Africa is on your radar, now you begin to ask, why are those minerals that come out of Africa and end up in my cell phone so important? Mm. And why is the biggest deposit of those resources in the Congo, and the Congo can't take care of itself, yet that resource flows out of the Congo very freely?
You make a very interesting parallel between African Americans in this country who fought in World War II, came back saying, you know, I want some of those same freedoms and rights that I was fighting for in Europe. And the fact that in these colonized countries in Africa also sent Africans to fight in World War II, they came back essentially wanting some of those same freedoms. And I thought that that parallel was pretty powerful.
You know, this is, I think, a dimension of World War II which is often overlooked. The fight against the Nazis and their ultimate defeat raised some major questions about what does it mean to be a human being? What does citizenship mean? And what rights does one human being have in comparison to another? And, you know, I mean, in some ways, you could say that Germany tried to colonize France and Poland. And look at the results. It was devastating to the people of France and Poland. And it was devastating to the economies of those countries, to the infrastructures of those countries. Nothing good came out of that. Germany was an extremely racist country in regards to Africans, in regards to Jews, in regards to many subgroups within their population. This was catastrophic. You know, genocide took on a different meaning. And so now when we reflect back on that, we have to see that this produced a profound change in terms of our thoughts about humanity. Mm-hmm. We got a Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We begin to question how people are treated in their societies. A government doesn't have the right to just treat its people anyway. African Americans came back and said, yes, I fought for that. I want to be able to sit where I want to sit. I want to be able to vote. I want some economic entree into the great dreams that are going around the world. A similar thing happened in Africa.
Well, in fact, you interviewed a number of those people who had fought or were connected to the war and the kind of passion that they had about bringing back some of those ideas and putting them to work and, in a sense, getting rid of the colonizers.
We talked to people on all sides of the war, some who fought in the war, some who were opposed to Africans fighting in the war, some who were colonial administrators during the fight in the war, some who were freedom fighters fighting against the government, the colonial governments, during the time of the war. And that kind of gives you, I hope, a rounded view of what role did World War II play in Africa and what role did Africans play in World War II? Because some people don't know. Millions of Africans fought and died in Europe, in Asia, fighting during World War II to preserve democracy and to open up the world to freedom. And so when these Africans came back home, they said, okay, that time is over when I'm going to just be a colonial subject. Let me rise up. Let me have access to it. Let me participate in voting. Let me have some rights. That totally changed the conversation about colonialism, because now you could not have the old kind of colonialism. Those days were gone. Africans wanted to be equal partners in running the world. And this is beautiful. It's as beautiful as the American Revolution because it transforms what we think freedom is. See, the American Revolution did that for the world, but it was not until the Civil War that we said, okay, we have to change even the Constitution to recognize humanity, to recognize citizenship, to recognize inclusion.
And why was Ghana? I mean, it seems like Ghana sort of led the way for other countries in Africa.
Ghana was a very important nation because of its pan-African sentiment. You know, some people forget that Ghana, when it got its independence, it's basically proclaimed this is meaningless unless it is connected to the independence of the entire continent. And so we need to spread the ideas. We need to spread support. We need to do things to help all of the other societies. It wasn't the first nation on the African continent to get independence, but it was the first country in sub-Saharan Africa to get its independence. And so none of those countries which had came before it stood up and demanded independence for all of the other countries. And that in principle was because of Kwame Nkrumah. Kwame Nkrumah had been one of the principal organizers of the 5th Pan-African Congress, which happened in 1945 in Manchester, London. And as a consequence of that experience and a consequence of other experiences flowing from this conference, he was dedicated to the Pan-African idea, which saw, you know, places like Ghana and Kenya and Tanzania and South Africa as states within a unified African continent. That still doesn't exist today. However, that's the way they were imagining it. And that has implications for the rest of the continent. Of course, the movements occurred locally. So the movement in Nigeria occurred in Nigeria, but it occurred within this larger Pan-African and larger context of national independence movements taking place all over the world, in Asia, in Latin America, in the Caribbean. This was a mass international movement.
About a minute before our first break here, but how much do you think of that colonial history still, in a sense, haunts Africa?
It haunts Africa, but it haunts us all. You know, as ghosts do, they try to not be so contained because it haunts the relationship of Africa with the rest of the world. You see, it's really important, I think, to kind of embrace the notion that Africa is a continent full of human beings. And they have all of the flaws and the beauties of everywhere else. A place like, for example, the United States is full of human beings. We have some of the beauties and flaws of everywhere else. And so the legacy of colonialism put in place institutions which did not serve the purpose of Africans. These were colonial institutions which were directed at serving and benefiting the rest of the world before it considered Africa. By inheriting those institutions, many of the leaders came into place and they did not think of their own people first.
That's our guest, Tekufu Zuberi, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about a new documentary he just made called African Independence. He's also a history detective on the PBS show called The History Detectives, and he's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Children's Beach House, and the third annual Plein Air Brandywine Valley, a painting and photography competition, exhibition, and sale. For 1 week, 100 painters and photographers will interpret the beauty of the Brandywine Valley. Their work will be judged, on display, and available at the opening gala Friday, October 25th at the Winterthur Museum in Wilmington. The art show and sale continues throughout the weekend and is open to the public. For gala tickets and schedules, pleinairbrandywinevalley.org.
Four pirates on board. Four pirates coming towards us down the main deck.
Tom Hanks stars in the new movie Captain Phillips, based on the true story of a 2009 attack by Somali pirates that led to a hostage drama at sea ended by Navy sharpshooters. On the next Fresh Air, we speak with Hanks and the film's director, Paul Greengrass. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Inishnua Theatre Company supports WHYY, dedicated to staging contemporary plays from Ireland, England, Scotland, and Wales. Inishnua is currently presenting the American premiere of Blink by English playwright Phil Porter, directed by Tom Ring, October 7th through October 29th at the Off Broad Street Theatre, 1636 Sansom Street. More information is online at tellthestory.us. tellthestory.us.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, and if you're just joining us, Tukufu Zuberi is our guest today on the show. He's the Lasry Family Professor of Race Relations, also a professor of sociology and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania. There are two exhibits here in Philadelphia of some of his work, one at the Penn Museum, the other at the Independent Seaport Museum. And on October 17th at FIME, the Penn Museum will be showing his new film called African Independence, and that's what we have been talking about. And if that weren't enough, he's also one of the hosts of the History Detectives on PBS. I think just finished up your 11th season. Do I have that right?
11 seasons 11. On television.
There you go.
Okay, and this is a beautiful thing.
Indeed it is. Let me see what Alex from Glenside has to say. Alex, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks so much, Marty.
You're welcome.
Great show. And thanks. Professor Tukufu Zuberi. Your work is always inspiring and insightful on issues about Africa. My question to you, Professor Zuberi, is what role might Africans in the diaspora play in shifting or changing the image of Africa globally? That's one. And then hopefully, can I get you to come and speak to the students at Acadia University someday?
Well, we'll put you on hold for that.
But
we'll talk about the role of the diaspora.
I think that this is a wonderful question. And I believe that the Africans in the diaspora, both those who are part of the historic diaspora, as occasioned by either the trade in slaves or have ancestors which migrated to the United States many, many years ago, freely, not as slaves, and that did happen. But also those more recent immigrants from the African continent who have just arrived, that all of these versions of the African diaspora have a very important role to serve. Because, you know, the myths that exist about Africa are there because people don't realize the significance of Africa to the world, and they have not taken the time to look at Africa as it is. And as a consequence of that, there is a lot of ignorance. But to confound the ignorance, to make the ignorance worse, there is a kind of arrogance about it. And that is that you will find some people who say, I don't know anything about Africa, and I don't need to know anything about Africa. My God, I'm a teacher. So, you know, that's violating everything I am about. If you don't know something about something, then you need to know more about it. Now, the African diaspora can serve a very important role here. But the first thing they have to do is educate themselves about Africa. Because just because you come from Africa doesn't mean you know about Africa. And you might come from Ghana, and that does not mean you know about Ghana. If you come from Nigeria, it does not mean you know about Nigeria, but it does mean that you're in an ideal and perfect space to know about Nigeria, to know about Ghana, to know about Kenya, to know about Tanzania, and to help others around you understand that, and to better represent what those places are about. Now, the reason this is so important is because whenever you find ignorance and it's confounded by arrogance, you have the perfect situation for misunderstanding, bias, prejudice, and discrimination. And one thing that is clear, as long as people are ignorant and arrogant about Africa, they will always be ignorant and arrogant about the African diaspora, whether they got here through slavery or they got here recently on a boat, plane, or however they got here. So ignorance about Africa is bad for the African diaspora.
Alex, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. So when was your first trip to Africa and where did you go?
My first trip to Africa was to Dakar, Senegal, and it was around 1985, somewhere around there.
And did you go because you were looking for your roots or you to understand sort of where you came from?
I was extremely politically active at that time. And so we were protesting about, you know, the apartheid in South Africa, about the various kind of conflicts and situations that continue to plague the African continent, the presence of dictators who were causing tremendous problems in these newly independent states. And I wanted to see Africa with my own eyes. I wanted to experience it because much of what I had felt, I thought it was just romantic and it was romanticizing the continent. And I knew that that couldn't be good. And I needed to get some powerful experiences. And once I went to Africa and I got some of the dirt in my hands, so to speak, I continued to go. And so, you know, from then on, I can say that I've canvassed most African countries, north, south, east, west. I have been there.
Well, and I'm as a kid, went to Africa, went to East Africa for about 6 weeks or so. And to be honest with you, I've never seen anything like it. It sort of changed my vision of what a nighttime sky looks like, for instance. And that is a pretty extraordinary thing to see. But I've always struggled with people like Robert Mugabe or Charles Taylor. I mean, and struggled with the level of violence. And it seems like revenge violence that we see in certain parts of, in certain countries in Africa.
See, this is how I start, okay? Because, you know, I was born in Oakland, California. I've been living in the United States my entire life with some short stays in African countries, teaching and things of that nature. But I look at it like this. Africa has been independent now for about 50 years. Let's not make the mistake and compare Africa 50 years after its independence with the United States 50 years after its independence, because that would be just frightening, okay? Because the United States 50 years after its independence, all those slaves, okay, come on. Somebody walk with me. Let's just be real about the situation and be historical about it. So there is a process of state formation which leads to a lot of conflict and confusion, and there is a struggle, a necessary struggle to create the national identity. That's what history teaches us. Is Africa going through that? No doubt. Are there problems on the African continent? No doubt. Are some of those problems violent? No question. The bombing in Kenya recently is a clear example of that. The war and the conflicts in Libya, in Egypt, in Somalia, you know, in Sudan, all of this is there. We have to recognize it being there. But at the same time, we have to recognize this as positive efforts for people to create a more democratic space, a more equal space, a space where people have the freedom to cultivate and develop their potential to make a contribution to life. And this is beautiful.
Let me get Lee from, looks like Winmore, to join our conversation. Lee, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks, Marty. Appreciate it. Actually, I'm a former colleague of Dr. Zuberi's. Used to work at Penn. Lee Nunnery here.
How you doing?
I'm well, thank you. And thanks for all of what you're doing. My big issue, being an educator, is how to break this down, how to disseminate this so that young children who currently feel that they have no value begin to understand what genealogical, what historical, what traditional strength there really is from that mother continent. It is clear in all the work I'm doing that young people are lost and they're drifting. And I just wonder if you have any ideas about how we can promote this as a positive so that they will get back on some positive track. I'll check my answer off there.
Thanks, Lee, for the call. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, Lee, and thank you very much for your call. Lee's one of my colleagues and one of the cats that that we struggled with as we help pin progress in these areas. So I really do respect and appreciate your question. Let me say this, that what you have brought up is something that is so important. It is so important. It is so important for a young child to be able to think as they let their imagination wander and to think about a place that everybody's identifying them with and to think about it positively. That is important for a child to do. Even if there are problems there, they should not think that the problem is them. They have to be able to think of the problems in Africa as being a consequent of Africa evolving, Africa developing, Africa finding its own footing. And that finding is an important process. Does it create problems? Yes. Does it create difficulties? Yes. But we also need to find in Africa that beauty that was Egypt, that beauty that was the Sudan, that beauty that was Mali, that beauty that was a Songhai, that beauty that came out in the form of the individuals who represent those societies. And this is, it goes both into kind of like an individual historical genealogy, which has nothing to do with our biological makeup, but has a lot to do with how the culture identifies us, how we identify ourselves, and then the connections that we have with the rest of the world. See, it's important to note, the United States is a country of immigrants. And with the, you know, the indigenous Native Americans, almost everybody in this country claims some descendancy from, somewhere else in the world. And this is important because those somewhere else's in the world then become a compartment of our own individual identities. So the young boy sitting in the class who only hears, oh, Africa, that's the place the slaves came from. That's the place where they have wars all the time. That's the place where the babies starve all the time, begins to get a certain mindset about that part of their identity. So they're not made whole. How do you make them whole? You give them a prism by which they can understand the starvation. They can understand the wars. They can understand all of this. And that has to happen by the diffusion of information and educating people about the African continent. So we have to create better tools and better resources for children to have access to what's going on in Africa and what has happened in Africa. I mean, these are heroes and sheroes from the African continent that we show in our film. These are idols, women and men, that children can identify with, who are living and have spent their life engaged in positive struggle to make the African continent a better place. And here they are talking about the need to do that and connecting it to the beautiful struggles going on all over the world, the processes of sustaining human life and elevating freedom and elevating democracy and elevating human equality. That's the thing we need to bring to these children. They're going to be inundated with the notion that Africa is a place. All they're going to hear about is the Charles Taylors and the Mugabes. What about the positive leadership in Africa? Will they ever hear those people speak? Mm. Will they ever hear them? And that's what we did in this film. We brought those voices to them. And we said, judge them for what they have said. And we didn't give a lot of commentary on what they said. We just presented their voices, hoping that people will get a sense that this movement was fundamentally important. Let me tell you a small story.
Well, let me just reintroduce you before you do that, because I need to make sure our listeners know who's talking, and that's our guest, Tekufu Zuberi. And we've been talking about his new documentary. It's called African Independence. And in fact, the film will be shown at the Penn Museum in Philadelphia on October 17th at 5 o'clock. There's also an exhibition of some of his war posters called Black Bodies and Propaganda. That's also at the Penn Museum. And the Independent Seaport Museum here in Philadelphia hosting another of his exhibits. It's called Tides of Freedom, African Presence on the Delaware River. And again, our guest is the Lasri Family Professor of Race Relations, Professor of Sociology and Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me just interrupt you only because we've got a lot of callers that want to get in on the conversation, including Matt from West Philadelphia. And Matt, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you, and thank you both.
Sure.
My question is regarding the visual representation of Africa. I've even seen at an African history museum, sort of the number one image you get is this natural wildlife safari, wildlife imagery. And I find it really offensive to the humanity of the African people that that's sort of the first image that is presented, and it becomes the first image that comes to mind. And so my question is to the professor,
sure,
what would be your visual montage to, I guess I'll have to see the movie, which I'm excited to check, but what would be, you know, what would be some of the more inspiring imagery that would be a better representation of the human culture of Africa? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Matt, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I guess a non-safari image.
And that your question is beautiful. I love that. So I close my eyes and I see the calculator. I see the computer. I see the cell phone. I see the new iPhone, the blue one. I see all of these things connected to Africa. I see industrialization. I see the importance of oil and the whole kind of petrol economy that we've created. And I see Africa serving a central role in all of this. And see, sometimes we forget how important Africa is because the only view we have, as you've rightly put it, is a nice elephant. And elephants are nice. They're cool, man. I like them too. Tigers are nice. They're cool. Lions are nice. They're cool. All of this is beautiful. And I've been on safari after safari after safari. But we need to have an appreciation, as you've rightly directed us, in terms of what role does Africa play in modern life? Because now the world is small. So if Africa's participating in modern life, it's not only going to affect Africans, it's going to affect you and I. Someone might call in on their cell phone. Calling in on their cell phone, they should recognize that they most likely have a piece of Africa in their hand. And not recognizing that piece of Africa, that role of Africa, is to not recognize the centrality of Africa in the modern world. How much of the oil used in the United States today came off the African continent? You see, we have to get beyond some of the stereotypic limitations we have about how we understand the universe we live in, how we understand how we are one people, really breathing in the same air on the same planet.
Well, and we're almost up on a break here, but what I imagine and see are solar panels. And
yes.
We've done shows about people saying there's, you know, once we figure out how to harness solar energy, Africa is going to play a huge role in trying to power the world.
That's right. And it's already playing a huge role in the atomic energy that we use, the nuclear resources. I mean, you start talking about where is the uranium coming from that's powering these plants. And you see that Africa is a major supplier of uranium all over the world. And its potential reserves of uranium are extremely vast and essential for human energy. And the potential of Africa for contributing solar energy is off the page.
And that's Tukufu Zuberi, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He has just made a new documentary titled African Independence. And again, two exhibitions of his work, one at the Penn Museum here in Philly and the other at the Independence Seaport Museum. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Waldron Mercy Academy, a private coeducational Catholic school, supports WHYY, offering child care beginning at 3 months old, traditional pre-K for 3 and 4 year olds, kindergarten, Montessori pre-primary, and 1st through 8th grades. Waldron Mercy Academy is located on a 35-acre campus in Marion Station. To learn more, there's an open house on October 27th at noon, 610-664-9847 or waldronmercy.org. Waldron Mercy Academy, celebrating 90 years in mercy.
Political cartoonist Tony Auth worked for the Philadelphia Inquirer for nearly 4 decades before joining WHYY's Newsworks.org. Now experience his work in his new home, WHYY, to stir, inform, and inflame. A thought-provoking exhibition of Tony Auth's work runs now through November 8th. The exhibition was organized by the James A. Michener Art Museum in Doylestown to stir, inform, and inflame. For hours and information, whyy.org/events.
All sorts of families face legal issues around divorce, custody, reproductive technology, marriage, and unions. In her new book, Keeping It Civil, family lawyer Margie Claw considers these very personal issues through the lens of an attorney who practices law with compassion. On the next Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, Claw's window into the world of contemporary families. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowain talking with Tukufu Zuberi about a whole host of things, including his new documentary titled African Independence, which will be shown at the Penn Museum in Philadelphia on October 17th at 5. And I do want to talk to you a little bit about the history detectives. You've been on that show for some time now, but I'm also interested in the fact that you mentioned that you grew up in Oakland. It sounded like you were pretty political. You were born with the name Antonio McDaniel.
Yes.
So where did Tukufu Zuberi come from?
You know, I was born in Oakland I was born in 1959, and the 60s is something I lived through as a child. So it really put an imprint on me, and I really identified with it. When I was a child, I lived in the projects in Oakland called Tassafaranga Project. And in Oakland, the Black Panther Party used to come to my neighborhood, pick up kids, and take them to a breakfast program. And for us, it was like, man, these cats are giving away food. And so we used to get a great breakfast. And they also had these programs of giving us medical tests, like sickle cell anemia tests. Uh-huh. And they would, give us some political education in the process. And that really sensitized me to being socially responsible and to recognizing that I had a responsibility to do whatever I could to help other people. And, people, you do what you're good at, hopefully.
If you're lucky.
And somebody will pay you to do that. If you're lucky. And I'd lucked up on doing that by becoming a professor. And I saw early on that I got a kind of track scholarship to go to San Jose State. And, on a track scholarship.
Because you ran track, right?
Because I ran track. I was good. Oh, yes. We ran all kind of state championships when I was at Oakland High. And I went to San Jose State, which is renowned because, this is the school of John Carlos, Tommy Smith, Lee Evans, and a whole bunch of other great runners. And I was so happy to be at San Jose State because of the track. But what happened is that in that first year, as I was running track, I became more politically conscious because of the earlier contact with the Panther Party. And I found myself spending more time in the library than I did on the track. And that led me to a kind of renewed sense of understanding of myself and a kind of likeness with those people who had been involved in the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement, the Pan-African movement, all of this. And I was like, what can I do to show that I identify with that? I'm doing the movement stuff, but I need to make a commitment, which I'm going to have to stand by for the rest of my life. And people were changing their names to show and reflect this commitment. And I took that big step. And it wasn't random.
I figured Tukufu means
beyond praise and strength. And to me, that is a challenge. And it is a challenge for me to live a life which is not just just based on praise and is not just a reflection of my strength, but in some ways is my humble contribution to making it a better place for all of us on this planet. And I try to do that by education, because I'm an educator, and that's how I try to do it.
So if you go back to the neighborhood, I don't know if you do, are there people that know you there as Antonio or Tony? Or
there are. Now, you know, I mean, of course, now that people see me,
yeah,
they've made the
different
connection. And I was back at the Oakland International Film Festival showing African Independence, and a lot of people came out from my high school and from my youth to say, hey, we know who you are. We know you haven't been coming to, you know, reunions and all of this other stuff. And that was wonderful. And I reconnected there with my best friend in high school, this guy named Douglas Ouyang. And we reconnected, had dinner, and have stayed connected ever since that time. And so, you know, the West Coast for me is a place that really gave me my push and start. But it's that West Coast which was, let's do something to make it a better world. Let's not just follow what's going on. Let's make it a better world. We can do it. And part of it is starting with us. Make yourself a better contribution to what it is. And that's what my name change was all about.
Well, I do want to get back to our callers, and I do want to talk to you a little bit about the history detectives as well. But let me get to, looks like Frank from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. And Frank, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning.
And let me thank the professor for the wonderful job he's doing.
Thanks.
My name is Frank, and I'm from Ghana. I studied Nkrumah at length. I'm an Nkrumahist, and I believe in the black man and in humanity. My humble submission is that if you destroy a people's culture, as has been the case of Africa for centuries, from slavery through colonialism to the present time, it is not just Africans who lose out, but the totality of humanity. Because, like the professor mentioned earlier on, we live in a globalized world. So whatever a group of people has benefits the rest of the world. So the destruction and decimation of Africa's cultures, rich cultural heritage, Africans will not only be the losers, but the entire world will ultimately be the losers.
Well, Frank,
therefore, it is my humble prayer that this will stop.
Well,
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. It sounds like a sort of a man after your own heart there.
Yes. Thank you very much, Frank, for your comments. I think we're on the same page. And I just want to offer one thing that I think is inherent in what you're saying. And that is the effort to destroy African culture was not successful. Bam. The effort to destroy African culture was not successful. African culture, you can find it in the music. African culture, you can find it in mathematics. African culture, you can find it in philosophy. African culture, you can find it painted all over everything that is out here. Has some of it been perverted in terms of those demonstrations? Of course. But the effort to destroy African culture was not totally successful. But I agree with you that the very effort to destroy African culture is damaging to all of humanity and is an affront to all of humanity, because the destruction of one culture is a threat to the integrity of all culture. And trying to simply destroy something for the advantage of a small group of people can never be good.
Frank, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I'm going to make a very awkward segue from that to the History Detectives on PBS. And as I said, you just completed your 11th season there. First of all, how did they find you? I mean, this goes back a good decade, but how did you end up being one of the hosts of the show?
I just want to repeat that 11 seasons of the History Detectives. You know what? I do not quite know
really
how they found me, but I'm going to tell you what I think it was. WHYY did a program after we did this program. There was a program that came on called Africans in the Americas. And then we did 30-minute slots right after that. And they called me and asked me, would I do something with a couple of other scholars? And I said, look, that's going to be boring, and
yeah,
ain't nobody going to understand it. But put me on there with some average, everyday people, and I'll show you guys something you ain't never seen before. And they said, okay. And they did it. So WHYY put me in a room with an architect, a journalist, and a student. And they came on there. They didn't know anything about slavery. They was like, what? We watched the episode, and then we would respond to it. And they're like, what were they talking about here?
Yeah.
We had this wonderful conversation about why it is so important for a white man to identify with the enslaved as his kinfolk. Why it is so important for a young mixed African American girl to relate to the enslaved as a fundamental shaper of what freedom means, what democracy means, what equality means, because that's what the Civil War was about. And that's what the kind of understanding the harmful experience of enslavement is about, is because of what it offers when you get out. So I think they looked at those episodes and said, let's put the guy on the History Detectives. And when we did that, we thought it was going to be 1 year, and I was like, walking around, hat tilted to the side. I was on History Detectives for a year, and now here we are a year together. My hat still tipped to the side, and I'm like, 11 years, baby, what you got to say?
Well, I know that being on that show got you collecting some of these war posters, and one of them was featured on the show. It's a poster called Our Colored Heroes. It goes back to 1918. It was made in Chicago. We're on the radio, but nonetheless, it's I think it is possible to describe what's in this poster.
It is. Now, okay, these posters are all propaganda, and propaganda is used to mobilize people. And in times of war, propaganda is used to mobilize them for war. And you want to get everybody on board. So when you look at this poster, okay, 1918, here's a brother. Got his foot on a white man that he done killed that's on the ground. Got a knife in his hand.
These are soldiers, too, we should say.
Yes, a soldier. And he's got a uniform on, a U.S. uniform. And he's got a knife in his hand and sticking in the chest of a German with a German uniform on, in his chest. And scattered on the ground is a bunch of other white men that this black man done killed. 1918. So the imagery here is contrary to everything we would think about for happening in 1918, because 1918 was the age of Jim Crow. 1918 was the age when African Americans did not have the vote. It was a period of time when African Americans could not move in any neighborhood they wanted to. They could not appear on any radio program they wanted to. They could not eat at any restaurant that they wanted to. They could not drive into any part of the city that they lived in that they wanted to. But in this post, you have this contrary racial imaging going on. And that's because these posters were made in order to glorify the role that African Americans were playing in the fight during World War I. And it was made to provide a positive and to encourage and promote a positive attitude towards the war effort among African Americans, many of which didn't support the war effort because they didn't have freedom here.
But as we were talking about before we going on the air, this was a poster that you might have seen in the North, but no way was this poster going to be seen in the South.
This poster ain't going to be in no Jackson, Mississippi. Come on. This poster's not going to be hanging in Atlanta. This is a poster you're going to find in Philadelphia. This is a poster you're going to find in Chicago, in New York. And those places had their racial problems, too, because when the soldiers came back, they rioted against the soldiers. However, you could have this kind of poster in your home, in those places, and not have to hide it if white people came to your house, and not be afraid of retribution. But in the South, you would have been afraid for retribution, because freedom did not exist for everyone in the United States in 1918. And this poster was challenging that.
Let me get that. Looks like Irv from Cherry Hill to join our conversation. And Irv, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, quite a few comments. To begin with, I take exception to the use of culture as opposed to cultures. In Africa, there are at least 500 languages. And consequently, to speak about some sort of pan-African culture is problematic for me. But I wanted to talk about the issue of tribalism, politics, and colonialism. I think one of the major issues in Africa today is indeed tribalism, as reflected in the composition of political parties, particularly after independence. Now, a lot of that was a result of colonialism, which carved up Africa, ignoring traditional tribal boundaries, and put together peoples who have perhaps even warred against each other. And you see this both in certainly in Nigeria and in Kenya.
And Irv, if I can just stop you there, only because I'm looking at the clock and I want to make sure that our guest has a chance to respond.
I may have missed this. I tuned in the middle of your show.
Okay.
However, I wanted to hear what the gentleman's comments on tribalism as a problem in Africa today.
Okay, fair enough. Go ahead.
So I think one of the points that I made earlier, maybe you didn't hear it, is there's over 2,000 languages on use in on the African continent. You know, you have over 53 nations in Africa. And what you're calling tribalism is something that was created and exaggerated on the African continent for purposes of maintaining colonialism. And one of the things that I said earlier is that these governments on the African continent were primarily created in the ghost of this colonial experience. So not only were the economies directed outside of Africa, but the internal politics got shaped and formed without a consideration for how do you make a nation state? How do you create and cement a nation state? And that, you know, one of the big problematics for Africa, and we don't have a lot of time, but I hope you come see the film because we directly address what the context of this question is and this question itself. But that one of the issues that really has to be understood when we talk about the African continent is how the African continent is being kind of pulled in to the world's problems. I mean, nobody blew up that whole incident at that mall in Kenya wasn't simply a result of the government in Nairobi or the people of Kenya. It was a result of an international struggle going on around ideas and beliefs and power, and also the policies internationally going on. Now, is that just Africa that's going on in? No, that's also going on with the United States. And in the United States, sometimes you've had presidents stand up and put it in terms of Christianity against Islam. And not your current president. He hasn't said that kind of thing. But that this is the kind of debate that has been going on. So I don't want to just say that problem is an African problem. It is an international problem. Has Africa been affected by it? Yes. But I don't want to just cut that in a way which just brings up an old stereotype that basically it's a bunch of African tribes and they've been fighting for generations and they're going to continue to fight. I would suggest to you that the current fights are a result of a legacy of fighting.
Irv, thanks for the call to Radio Times, and to Kufu Zuberi, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you very much.
You're
welcome. It's been fun.
Fun for us as well. And the film is called African Independence. You can see it at the Penn Museum in Philadelphia, October 17th at 5 o'clock. And again, our guest is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, professor of race relations, sociology, and Africana studies. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Artie Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.